King Reel number 5. Are there any other episodes of this period at the concentration camp that stand out in your mind?
Well, yes. Being in number 5 squadron, the different squadrons were organised more or less by the engines in the aircraft. And number 5 had gnome engines, 80 horsepower gnomes. And these engines used pure castor oil. So when you put them away at night after the flying, you always used to put the engine so that the bottom cylinder had its exhaust valve open, and then the oil used to run through the exhaust valve and out away from the engine. If you forgot to do that, bottom cylinder would fill up, and so the next day when you went to start it up, all that oil would come suddenly out of the exhaust valve and flop right in your face. And at that time the fitter and the rigger had to more or less overlap. We had to know a little bit about each other's work. And one of the weaknesses of the gnome engine was not exactly in the engine itself, but in the engine bearer. And it was found that these bearers used to gradually acquire a crack. It was a steel plate, and you got a spider crack which gradually opened. And we had to keep a sharp lookout for that and examine the engine bearer every day. Well, one morning my aircraft was ready to fly, and my officer, Lieutenant Glanville, said to me, when you've done the machine, I want you to come down to Farnborough with me. I said, yes. And I started to examine the machine, fill it up, and I looked at the engine bearer, and to my dismay, there was a slight crack in it. And I thought to myself, now if I report that crack, he won't get that machine, I won't get a flight to Farnborough. If I don't say anything about it, I'll get a lovely flight to Farnborough, and I'll be able to shoot a wonderful line about it, because we did a very, very few times we got a chance to fly. So I said nothing about it. I started up the aircraft, climbed in, and away we went. And we flew round, and on the road we came over Basingstoke. And over Basingstoke, I leaned right over the aircraft to look at the town, and I accidentally switched a switch off. By the way, it was a dual control machine, and I accidentally switched the engine off. And for the roar of the engine, there was a sudden silence and just a switching in the wires. And the pilot began to swing her around and put the nose down to try and find a landing ground. But before he could got very far with that manoeuvre, I saw what I'd done, and I switched the engine on. It picked up immediately, and we picked up the nose, and away we went. When we got to Farnborough, he made a rotten landing. I thought, this is a good chance to find the cracked engine bearer. And when it had stopped, he said, I'm sorry I made such a rough landing. I said, well, I must apologise to you, sir. I'm sorry I switched the engine off. Oh, he said, is that what it was? I thought you just cut out for a bit. I said, no, I just accidentally switched off with my sleeve caught in the switch. He said, well, we'd have been in all right. He said, I saw a field I should have glided into, so it was quite all right. And then we talked like that, and he said, well, get the aircraft put away. And I looked at it, and then I said, I'm afraid the engine bearer's gone, sir. He said, yes, that was my rough landing, I suppose. And that ended that one.
In the summer of 1914, with the growing possibility of war being declared, did these overtures have any effect upon the squadron?
Well, the only overtures it had, as far as I remember, was a fear that we might not go overseas, that we might be left behind. Everyone was dead keen to go wherever the war was and take place in it. After all our training, we wanted to try it out. And we all went back from our respective stations, and we more or less stood by. And leave was stopped. So at the finish, when war was declared at midnight, We started right away to Folkestone that very same night, and we were in France by 7 o'clock the next morning.
Oops. Could you tell me what took place at Gosport on the outbreak of war in 1914?
Well, just some weeks before the war, everyone thought that war was imminent, and one of the things they did, they started to train us in with rifles. We had rifles and we did shooting and practice of aiming and things like that, and we used to use the moat for our range. It was a dry moat, and we learned the rifle, and we used to do guards with rifles instead of pistols. And when a day or two before the war, we started to pack up. Now, the RFC was entirely mobile. We were never dependent on any static apparatus of any kind. And we just put our squadron equipment into Leyland lorries and light stuff in Crossley tenders. And we only had those two, all Leylands or Crossleys, no other aircraft. So the move from place to place was not so difficult as one might think, because everything was planned to be mobile. So when war actually broke out, we packed up our lorries, store lorries, workshop lorries, and Crossley tenders, and made our way by road down to Folkestone. And there we loaded the lorries into a little old iron ship. It was called the Shevington, London. And the crane slung our lorries into the ship, fully loaded and ready to start off when they got the other side. And we went across there to France, and we landed at Boulogne. Well, we went across, as I say, and landed at Boulogne. But then when we got there, we found the French, that the cranes on the French docks were unable to lift the lorries out of the hold while they were laden. They were too weak or too small. So we had to unpack all the stores in the lorries, and the crane was able then to lift the empty lorry out and land it on the dock side. We had to land all the stores out on cranes and packed it all back into the lorries again before we could start. So that delayed us so much that the first move, we only went a few miles out of Boulogne to a little place called Vron, and there we spent the first night.
Could you describe for me now the various stages of the moves of number 5 squadron up to Maubeuge?
Well, the main thing, first of all, to say that we never travelled in any other way than by our squadron lorries and light tenders and of course, motorbikes. We're entirely able to travel. We're independent of railways or any other means of travel. We always went on our wheels, so to speak. The aircraft used to fly to a certain field. An aircraft, though, at that time could land in quite a small field. And the convoy, well, I'll call it the convoy now, used to go to up country as far as this field and service the aircraft, ready for taking reconnaissances. And they used to go on to and do a job and come back and be fueled up. Perhaps we'd stay one day or 2 days, and then we'd go a bit further up. Perhaps you'd only stay a matter of hours. But that was the principle, that we used to go along and service the aircraft as we caught up with them. Till at last we arrived at this place, Maubeuge. And at that time the harvest was in the fields of France. Mostly the corn had been cut, but it hadn't been carried. And sometimes it happened that the fitter and rigger was required to stay with his aircraft and stay the night. And then the light tender would fetch him on to join the squadron the next morning.
Could you describe Maubeuge as a base when you arrived there?
Yes, it was just a field outside the town, the same as any other field that we'd been in. As I said before, we used to stop overnight near a field And if the Federer and Rigger stayed on the aircraft, we used to get the shocks of wheat from the field and stack them up against the front plane, the front edge of the plane, and lie down under the plane. And if it rained, that kept us dry. And then the next morning, we'd service the machine, they would fly away, we'd go back on the Cressley tender and join the rest of the convoy. And that kept on that procedure till we arrived at Maubeuge. When we got to Maubeuge, which is a large field, there was lots of stores there, bombs and petrol, and all the stores required by the Royal Flying Corps. And other squadrons also arrived there. It was more or less a concentration. There was nothing special. There were no hangars there, nothing like that. Yes, at Maubeuge, it was just like any other field. But we settled down there, and that was supposed to be our advanced base. That's where we had these big supplies of petrol. And our pilots carried on with doing reconnaissances. But instead of going on any further, we stopped at Maubeuge. And by that time, we could hear heavy gunfire coming closer and closer. Till at last, shells began to fall in the bottom of the aerodrome. And so the commanding officer decided we must retire, which we did.
Did you have any contact with the French army while you were at Maubeuge?
Well, the French army provided a sort of a guard or a series of sentry posts in the perimeter of the field, right outside. They never came to where our aircraft were. Our aircraft were all out in the open, and we provided sentries to go round the aircraft just as they stood on the aerodrome. But the French, they provided sentries for the outside of the aerodrome. So if you wanted to go out of the aerodrome, you had to go pass by a French sentry. And the French seemed to be very nervous and jumpy at the time, and we didn't seem to be sure of each other. And as we couldn't understand each other's language, and they all seemed very handy with their long bayonets, we were rather frightened of them. And so we had almost no contact at all. We kept to ourselves and they kept to themselves, and that was the position.
How long were you at Maubeuge?
Well, it was only a matter of a few days, I think. The German advance, instead of being held up with the forts that they expected, it moved much more rapidly than anyone thought. And they advanced so near the aerodrome that they were firing shells which dropped actually in the aerodrome. And so we were ordered to retire. And the squadrons moved off in different directions. Number 5 kept to itself, but which way the other squadrons went, I don't know. But they set fire to stores and petrol and everything like that, and everyone took to the lorries and began to retire. And the aircraft flew back, pretty much the same as they had done coming forward. They flew back to a field and took the latest disposition of the enemy troops and supplied it to the commander, and so on. And we would stop perhaps 2 days at one place or perhaps 1 day at another, but we went back in very much the same way as we did before. But this evacuation of Maubeuge was not on the plan at all, because that was supposed to be the advanced striking base. But the Germans captured it with ease, and we had to retire, but we didn't lose any aircraft or any lorries. We just set fire to the stores, which had been amassed there. And we never stopped doing our usual work of keeping the aircraft going and the pilots taking reconnaissance views of the advancing Germans and the retreating British. But when we got onto the roads, there was real confusion. There was French units mixed with British units, refugees on the roads, and those narrow paved roads, they were made of cobbles, and if our lorries got off the cobbles, onto the side, the wheels would go into the soft mud at the side. They were so narrow, and the bridges were very narrow. Well, coming up, that didn't worry us much. But when we had to thread through refugees and units of the British and French army, it was very difficult and slowed us down. But we did still, somehow or other, keep doing our reconnaissances. And we went right back to, in that manner, to a place called Pizarche. And then we began to advance again, very slowly. And then we stayed longer at each place, each field where you happened to be. But on one occasion, we were coming along the road and we saw a squadron of French cavalry with rusty metal breastplates on, just like our lifeguards wear today. And these men had been in action with this steel breastplate on a helmet with a long red plume. Amazingly old-fashioned. They'd actually been into action in that dress. And that rather depressed us. I think the French were so old-fashioned. Of course, all the French infantry went into action with bright red trousers and a red cap and a blue coat, and they marched along without a step. They didn't shave. They evacuate anywhere. And we were rather depressed by all that, and we. Oh dear. Shit off, you'll run out of steam somehow.